for years to come. Make your tax-deductible gift online now at willpledge.org.
Greetings. It's 1 o'clock here at WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Champaign, Urbana, Illinois. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters. We're coming to you live today, December 11th, 2011. And we have a terrific show for you, a show I think you're going to really enjoy. Today, our guest is going to be Noam Chomsky for the full hour, talking to us from his phone line in Cambridge, Massachusetts. It should be a wonderful opportunity to speak with Professor Chomsky. I hope you'll join us today. In the meantime, before we get to our guest, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
Improving the quality of news and increasing diversity of viewpoints were the main topics of discussion at a recent Federal Communications Commission hearing in Atlanta. The event brought together nearly 200 people with FCC Commissioners Minion Clyburn and Michael Copps to talk about the state of the media in Atlanta and across the nation. Panelists spoke of the need for local news that serves their communities and the importance of including many different voices, especially those of women and people of color. Free Press senior advisor Joseph Torres reminded the audience that Atlanta was the home of the first African-American broadcast station and the site of the first major license challenge by African-American leaders against local broadcasters.
Despite such pioneering efforts, people of color still remain too absent in the media. In Atlanta, there's not a single full-power commercial TV station owned by an African-American. But Atlanta is not alone. African-Americans own just 8 full-power TV stations nationwide.
Torres pointed out why it's important for different groups of people to own their own stations.
Other people tell our stories. They often get it wrong.
Michael Copps has been an outspoken advocate for people-centered media during his 10-year tenure as FCC commissioner. At his last public hearing, he spoke passionately about the fight for democratic media.
Here in media democracy is a cause that goes to the roots of self-government, an issue that just about every other issue depends upon if we are really going to overcome. Tell the FCC what you think, but don't stop there. Tell all those who make public policy what you think. Use every outlet you can. And as for me, I may be leaving the commission soon, but I can guarantee you this. I intend to keep speaking out and working hard on this challenge. It is too important to stop now. It's too important for you not to be involved.
The state of the media was brought clearly into focus by audience member Donald King, who asked a pointed question that was answered loudly by silence and then laughter.
We should be standing room only here tonight. How many folks are here because you heard about this on TV or radio? Commissioners, that's the state of public news broadcasting in the Atlanta region today.
As our media landscape changes, with more people accessing news and information on the internet, the values that underline good journalism are the same: diversity, transparency, and accountability. But is digital media delivering good journalism? What about our legacy media outlets? The Mapping Digital Media Project, commissioned by the Open Society Foundation, examines the transition to digital media in 60 countries to help understand the rapidly changing media universe. Researchers examined everything from internet access to spectrum allocation to community, public, and commercial media. Tom Glazier, who co-authored the specific report on the United States, says it echoes similar reports that say traditional media models are under stress, with digital media models still trying to gain a footing. Quality journalism is at risk in both spheres.
Really, the report is a soup-to-nuts analysis of the media policies and media production in the United States today. It advocates and recommends a number of specific policies to really remake and redevelop media in a way that would better support our 21st century democracy.
Glaser says the unique aspect of this project is that it allows countries to compare their progress to and learn from each other. In the U.S., the report found that although people appear to have a growing number of news sources online, actual diversity in content remains weak. The report also said consumers are increasingly tuning in to partisan commentary on networks like Fox News and MSNBC rather than hard news.
The sad outcome is that it is public affairs broadcasting rather than news. It's generally talking heads discussing and critiquing things rather than introducing new ideas or in-depth reporting. I think what we have to think about is how we can bring more resources into news production rather than straightforward public affairs reporting.
The U.S. report calls for policies to promote greater media diversity, hold commercial media outlets accountable to their public interest obligations, and strengthen public and community media.
Quite simply, without good journalism, we won't have a good democracy. We need to think very seriously about how we hold politicians to account and how we support public engagement with policymaking. Traditionally, it's been journalists asking tough questions and holding people to account. That has to continue. We have to think about how that is sustained in tight economic times.
To read the full report, visit soros.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. Coming to you live today, December 11th, 2011, here in Urbana, Illinois. We've got a lot of great shows lined up for you two, including today, we hope. And it looks like we are... I'm looking into our engineering office. We're waiting to make our connection with Noam Chomsky, our guest today. Noam Chomsky is at the 50th anniversary of the Department of Linguistics and Philosophy at MIT, where he's gave the keynote address, as one might imagine today. And he's graciously agreed to pull away from that event to speak to us from his office phone. And we're trying now just to make our connection with him in what are trying circumstances. In the meantime, while Christina Williams, the producer for Media Matters, is hard at work with Kyle Kroha, the engineer, locating our guest, let me give you a little bit of an update on forthcoming shows that we have here on Media Matters. On December 18th, a week from today, we're going to have the editors of the Project Censored Yearbook going over the most censored news stories of 2011 that have been out there and discussing the quality of journalism and news media today. Then on Christmas Day, there will be special programming here on WILL. We'll be taking the day off. January 1st, we're going to have a recorded show with Katrina Vandenhoevel, the editor of The Nation magazine, talking about politics and media and, in general, one of our most popular guests. January 8th, we will come back to you with a live show with Tom Frank, the author of the new book, Pity the Billionaire, coming out in the beginning of January. We'll be talking about that book with Tom Frank. In the rest of January, we've got a number of outstanding guests, including Craig Aaron, the executive director of Media Matters. We also have Josh Silver, who is from the new group that has just started to work on campaign finance that's coming up. And we also are going to be dealing with some of the work of feminist work on coverage of women, portrayal of women in media that's being done recently. These are all shows that are coming for us forward in January. So we've got a pretty great schedule looking at you. And our guest today, though, the one we're most eagerly awaiting, is Noam Chomsky. And I think we're furtively at work now trying to make that contact. And I'm waiting word from the engineering studio to see if we have any luck. And nothing as of yet. If we can't make contact, if he has been detained for about 30 seconds or so, and we don't think we're going to be able to make a contact for today's show, we will reschedule Professor Chomsky for his first available time. And we will go to a replay of an interview we did a few months ago with Ralph Nader, which was an interview I think you'll greatly enjoy if you've not heard it. It might be worth listening to again if you have heard it. Ralph Nader, similar to Noam Chomsky, one of the great giant figures of the last 50 years of American politics and American intellectual life. And I think we're going to wait and get one last try here to see if we can get Professor Chomsky. And if we do not connect, I'm going to beg off here, and we'll let Professor let Ralph Nader take over. And again, if you do hear the voice of Ralph Nader with me, that means it's a recorded show. Don't call in. Just sit back, relax. I think there are callers on the original program, so don't be confused by that. So let's see. Let's give one last shot here. I'm looking in at our studio. I think, dear guest, I think we're going to go now to an earlier interview with Ralph Nader. I hope you enjoy it. We'll be back with you 1 week from today, and have a great week, everyone. Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today should need no introduction to anyone listening to this program. He is Ralph Nader, the legendary consumer activist and progressive political activist, joining us on the phone from his home, or his offices, I should say, in Washington, D.C. Ralph Nader, welcome to Media Matters.
Thank you very much, Bob.
Well, it's an honor to have you here, Ralph Nader. And what I'd like to do to start with in today's show, I think a lot of people are familiar with, younger listeners in particular, with the last 10 or 20 years of your career. One of the things I think is most interesting about your career is the arc of it and what it says about American politics, American political culture, our governing system. And maybe you could just start, if you wouldn't mind, by talking about when you got when you began as a consumer activist in the 1960s and into the 1970s, and what you were able to do in Washington then and accomplish compared to what it's like in the 1990s or this decade or the last 20 years, trying to do the same sort of work in Washington, how Washington has changed.
Well, it's changed as the corporations have gotten so powerful on both parties that the government's been closing down for over 25 years on citizen groups, national citizen groups like Sierra Club or Public Citizen or Common Cause. And so it's a very instructive question you've just posed. I lost a lot of friends when I was young in traffic crashes, and I got interested in why the auto companies don't put long overdue safety devices in cars, like seat belts and padded dash panels, stronger door latches, airbags, head restraints, and better brakes, better tires. And I realized there was no regulation, no safety regulation. So I went to Washington as a young man and developed a strategy where I got connections in the Senate and the House and powerful people with the press, regular coverage, some contacts in the White House in Lyndon Johnson's time and then Nixon's time. And we got the motor vehicle highway safety law through in 1966, which has saved over a million lives and many millions of injuries with simple installation of devices. And then did about another dozen laws, the key architecture of the environmental movement was the air and water pollution control laws that came out in the early 70s, and then the Product Safety Commission laws, and of course the Freedom of Information Act amendments in 1974 that gave us the best free information law in the world. None of these could be passed today. The great champions like Senator Magnuson, Chairman of the Senate Commerce Committee, Congressman Rosenthal, Congressman John Moss, and they're all gone. Their replacements are overwhelmingly corporate Democrats working with corporate Republicans. And so young people today are facing a real dip in any kind of Democratic mobilization in Washington, at least. And it's because of four things. The globalization weakened labor unions. They were a countervailing force. They were our allies, for example, in getting OSHA, Occupational Safety and Health Bill, through, and the Environmental Protection Agency. The second was the huge expansion of political action committees. We went from 400 in 1974 to probably 10,000, and they're all targeted for quid pro quos. Like you have the auto dealer PACs, you have the insurance PACs, the banking PACs, the oil PACs, and they're just swarming over Washington. And the third is was the systematic expansion of corporate lobbyists. As they grew, labor shrunk in Washington. And so, the drug industry will have 500 full-time lobbyists on Capitol Hill when they want something. 500. Plus, they're willing to spend $300-400 million in lobbying and campaign contributions in one year. So it's very hard for Sid Wolf of the Health Research Group, the Public Citizen, to counteract that sort of thing. And then the fourth is the two parties have converged. As you know, I've run for president because increasingly on corporate issues, the two parties are dialing for the same dollars. And rhetoric aside, in actual action, they have allowed more and more decisions in Washington to be made by about 1,500 corporations. So it's very difficult, and so we're at a low ebb now as a citizen community, and we've got to turn it around. And to turn it around, we've got to start with imagination. It's not enough simply to document abuses. As you know, you know better, and most people, we're in the golden age of expose documentaries, not just Michael Moore's, but a lot of others. There's never been more good documentaries exposing corporate crime, fraud, abuse, political influence, domestically and internationally, the military-industrial complex, great books out on Lockheed Martin, etc. And there's never been a time when there's been more books coming out with less national coverage. No longer can Bill Greider or Jim Hightower or Kuttner get on Good Morning America. They can't even get on Charlie Rose. Very rarely can they get on Diane Rehm or even public broadcast. And that's the hidden secret of public broadcast, because from a distance, it appears like public broadcast is this liberal bastion trying to ward off the right-wing claws in Capitol Hill at cutting their budget and so on. But in fact, public radio and public broadcasting have been overwhelmingly corporatized. They do put good programming, but as we'll discuss, they don't do the incisive programming and look at all their ads, you know, what this company gives and this trade group gives donations to public radio and public TV. It's very, very irritating now to see all the 15-second notices that they give. But they don't do as much muckraking as 60 Minutes of, you know, the corporation known as CBS. So, you know, between all of that, the gerrymandering of more and more districts so you have safe, reelectable districts, either Democrat-controlled or Republican-controlled, that's really the trajectory over the last 40, 50 years, a decline in access to the courts, to the regulatory agencies like the Food and Drug Administration, and to Congress. And so we're at a really low ebb. But, you know, American history has been cyclical, as Arthur Schlesinger Jr. has pointed out. But we're still waiting, and the Internet doesn't cut it. It does not cut it. Let me say that many times. It's a great medium to find out information, a great media to find out what meetings are going on, but lousy for motivating civic action. Nothing can motivate citizen action more than person-to-person meetings, starting in living rooms and moving to auditoriums and city council meetings and on up.
Our guest you've just been listening to is Ralph Nader, consumer activist. We're talking for the full hour with Ralph Nader today on Media Matters. The phone lines are open at 217-333-9455, and our toll-free number is open at 1-800-222-9455. Ralph, going back to the 60s and 70s,
sure.
You know, one of the things I remember growing up, and I came of age as you were coming into prominence in the mid to late 60s and into the 70s, was that you were at that time seen as a nonpartisan figure. I don't think, you know, you were highly respected across the political spectrum. You were not seen as anti-business, but rather as anti-corruption and pro-honest government. But I don't think anyone knew what your political views. You weren't sort of put into a corner and said you're a progressive and you're hostile, therefore, to these parties. I mean, do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, well, I worked at that. I was not a registered Democrat, Republican. I've always been independent. And I had to work with the good people on both sides on Capitol Hill, obviously mostly with the Democrats at that time, in the great environmental, worker, safety, consumer protection era. So you're right on that.
And, I mean, that clearly is no longer the case. Now when you go to the Hill, I mean, you're perceived as someone way off on sort of the radical fringe, I assume.
Well, it was because when the government started closing down, and it was the corporate government, we should always use an adjective, every major agency and department The biggest single outside influence is corporate lobbyists. They have 20, 30,000 of them here in town. They're all connected back home with their agents, insurance agents, and auto dealers, and all kinds of cash campaign money from their PACs. And they have their own media, of course. So I had to basically look at my friends in the civic community here with millions of dues-paying members back home and say, look, we're losing power. It's hard to admit it publicly, especially when you try to tell your contributors what you've been doing, working harder and harder for less and less. And so we just have to go into the political electoral arena in order to get some leverage over at least one of the major parties. Since we have a winner-take-all system, maybe they'll pay attention if some of the voters can sign off away from the Democrats or the Republicans, and I got votes from both, to another column. Well, little did I know that the mindset of 99% of the voters in this country is least worst. They may not like their favorite party, Democrat, Republican. They'll vote for the least worst. And unless you're a Perot with billions of dollars and you can be on the presidential debates, which have been controlled since then, since 1992, by the two parties, unless you get on TV because you can pay for it. Remember Perot's 30-minute presentations. The only way to get to tens of millions of people, no matter how much you campaign and how many Madison Square Garden type arenas you fill, as we did in 2000, you can only get through to 2% of the people compared to 50 or more percent on a presidential debate. So while it didn't work, largely not because of our energy, we had majoritarian agendas. Just look at VoteNader.org, which we've left open to show people our agenda, ignored by the Republican Democrats, about 16 items, including single payer and living wage and cracking down on corporate crime seriously. They're largely majoritarian agendas. So we've made the point, we've documented, we've won lawsuits on ballot access. But now it's up to the voter, to basically say to himself or herself, hey, what's my vote mean? Do I want to go least worst so every 4 years both parties are pulled by the corporate interests and both parties get worse, which is what's been happening? Or do I want to say, I'm not voting for you, Democrat, Republican, unless you accept certain of my conditions. And if you don't, I'm putting a column, on a third party or independent candidate, or I'm staying home. Unless we do that, so many of our reforms and your reforms and your great media conference that you just held in Boston will never get anywhere if the premise is they
all are waiting. But before we go to the phone lines, I want to ask one question, make sure we talk about it, because it doesn't get talked about a lot. And I know it's something that's near and dear to your heart, which is how the judicial system has changed in the last four decades. The court system, which, when I came of age in the 60s and early 70s, the courts were seen as, protectors of constitutional liberties and freedoms, and sort of they were on the side of the people. And now that almost seems like a comical statement.
That's part of the decline. The decline has been in citizens accessing all three branches of government, the executive, the legislative, and the judicial, and at the state level. And that's because, corporations are engaged in strategic planning. And the bottom line of the strategic planning is that they want control over everything that can give them sales or take away sales. That's called monopoly and corporate globalization and NAFTA, WTO, and all that. Or any control over any source of power that can challenge them. And one source of power is the judiciary, as you pointed out. Great environmental, civil rights, civil liberties victories in the past. And so they have been embarked on this tort deform, or they call it tort reform. So more and more wrongfully injured people are shot out of the courts, or if they get in, they can't get an adequate compensation award. They limit the awards by state law that are lobbied through by the insurance companies and the auto companies, the whole corporate cabal here. And, of course, the more the Republicans win, because the Democrats increasingly do not listen to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who's reelected four times, which is stand for the people and stop dialing for corporate dollars and stop being corporatist. So you get more Republican victories, and they appoint right-wing judges. And now you have that in the Supreme Court. And again, those politicians in the Supreme Court, Scalia and Thomas and others, 5-4, 5-4, 5-4, they are rendering decisions like Citizens United, which, as many of your listeners know, opened the floodgates so corporations now can spend unlimited money, like Exxon, to defeat or elect the candidates of their choice. So just think of democracy as 1,000 doors opening up to citizens, to give them voice, to give them remedy, to give them action, to give them collaboration rights like trade unions and cooperatives. And each one of these doors is either being closed or on the way to being closed by the spectacular day-after-day strategic planning of our government, of our politics, of our elections by corporations. They're planning our genetic inheritance, commercializing childhood, corporatizing education. I mean, that's what they do. They don't need conspiracies. That's what they do every day with their consulting firms and their trade associations. And it's about time we, the people, started planning our future as befits the preamble to our Constitution, which last I remembered did not start with we, the corporation. It started with we, the people.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Ralph Nader, who you've just been listening to. This is a live broadcast today, June 12th, 2011, so feel free to call in. The phone lines are open at 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to our first caller, line 4 of Villa Grove. You're on the air with Ralph Nader.
800-222-9455. Let's go to our first caller, line 4 of Villa Grove. You're on the air with...
Yes, line 4, are you there? Okay, I think we've had a little mix-up with line 4. Ralph, let me ask you a question, if I can, while we try to get our phone matters worked on here, about the Tea Party movement, which has sort of become the most heavily publicized sort of dissident movement of the last couple of years. What's your take on it?
Well, it's largely because of three reasons. One, it's a rebellion of the conservative libertarian wing of the Republican Party that, unbeknownst to many liberals, has been disrespected and excluded by the corporate Republicans of Bush, Cheney, and Wall Street. And they may call themselves Tea Partiers, and they may be different in their own way. They're not all the same. They're not Tea Partiers for the same reason, the same agenda. But I think the large part of them, it's a rebellion of the conservative libertarian ring. They are allowed to write the platforms of the Texas and Oklahoma Republican Party. But then after they get patted on the head, the corporate Republicans go to Washington and take over, and they don't listen to them. The second is they've had the benefit of Fox News. I mean, I've never had the experience, I guess you haven't either, of having a movement that has its own network. And every time that you announce a rally, there it is, leading the news to millions of people. Mm-hmm. So that has exaggerated the number and the strength of the Tea Party movement. And perception of power is power in Washington, D.C. And so the Republican norm are really frightened of these Tea Partiers. And some of them say they are in Congress now, and they give themselves the Tea Party label. And the third is the default of the left. You know, when the only movement that has a pulse is a movement that calls itself a Tea Party movement, the question is, why wasn't there a coffee party started? There was a small one by a woman in a Maryland suburb. But the point is, the left is stultified by the labor unions who aren't doing anything other than a few, like the United Electrical Workers or the California Nurses Association. The AFL-CIO is in a defensive posture, not willing even to criticize Obama, who's turned his back on the labor movement, has broken his promise to push for raising the minimum wage to $9.50 this year. It's $7.25 federal. And broken his promise to push for a card check and other forms of facilitating more and more labor unions by workers up against what is a very anti-union Taft-Hartley law. So that's my read. I think on some things I like the Tea Party, the portion of the Tea Party that is against the Patriot Act, that is against WTO and NAFTA, that is against corporate welfare handouts, giveaways, and bailouts, and that is against the enormous military budget that is designed to make profits for what Eisenhower warned us about in his farewell address, the military-industrial complex. Now, Ron Paul represents that kind of libertarian wing of the Republican Party.
You know, Ralph, on that point, Ralph Nader, I see what you're saying about the, aside from the Tea Party, say Ron Paul and that branch, that libertarian branch of the Republican Party. My sense from following them, not super closely, but with some attention, is that they're rather blind to the idea of corporate monopoly power and corruption. They might throw a rhetorical crumb that way, but when push comes to shove, it's not an issue they really want to push on.
It's very interesting. Like, they're very anti-government, and I say to them, well, who do you think controls the government? You think Wall Street controls the government? You think Main Street controls the government? Stop just saying the government. What your real complaint is, since you're against all these Wall Street bailouts, against all these crooked contractors, military contractors, it's against all the subsidies, et cetera, why don't you call it the corporate government? Because you're not going to beat the corporate government unless you separate that part of the government, prosecution of corporate crime, for example, from the corporate government that keeps the budgets for corporate crime enforcement low and keeps the subsidies for corporations high. So they do need to dialogue here, because I think they have some progressive allies on the other side. But you're right. You know, a lot of them really don't know what the score is. They're extremely simple in their ideological focus. Some of them know what the score is. And I've met a lot of libertarian conservatives, so to speak, or populist conservatives, which have long historic roots in our country, who do know what the score is. In fact, the American Conservative, which is a magazine, sort of Buchanan Republicanism, repeatedly has articles on criminal wars of aggression by the U.S. They have repeated articles about corporate welfare, and they have articles which you and I wouldn't agree with, but I think there is a potential convergence here that could have decisive political consequences between left and right.
Our guest, Ralph Nader. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. The phone lines are open at 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Let's hope our phone lines or system is working a little better now. Let's go to Champaign, line one. You're on the air with Ralph Nader.
Hi, Ralph. I have two questions, quick questions. One is, do you think it would do any good to have a mass movement on mass march to Washington on this? And the other is, maybe Obama is somewhat a victim of the system of campaign money raising, and after he's elected, maybe he'll turn around and do some of the stuff he wanted to do. Okay, that's it.
I wouldn't bet on the latter. We always thought that would be true. Well, I didn't, but some did, with Clinton, for example. It's very rare that a second-term president feels a sigh of relief and then becomes, quote, his true self. You know, no. Barack Obama was always a concessionaire to power. And in this city, it's corporate power. He is conflict-averse. And he is the type of politician who turns his back on the people who sent him here because they're not perceived as power players, millions of powerless voters, compared to the lobby power of Aetna and Pfizer and Merck and the Hospital Corporation of America, to take one industry that he buckled under in his rejection of single payer, which he said he really thinks is the best system, but it's not possible to pass it. Well, you're either a transforming president or you are a transacting deal-making president. But, you know, don't give up half of the pie before you start compromising the remaining half. And on the other thing, I would be in favor of any mass demonstration in March. And if it's to be done, do it on a weekday, because if you come here on weekends to Washington, the Congress is not there. And 50,000 marchers on Wednesday are worth 300,000 marchers on Saturday.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Now let's try line four again with Villa Grove. You're on the air with Ralph Nader.
300,000 marchers on Saturday.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Now let's try line
Looks
four.
Like we've got our reverb again here. I think we're going to have to bag you, line four. I'm sorry about that. There's some difficulties with our toll-free line. The local lines are open at 217-333-9455. Please use that line if you could going forward. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters. Our guest is Ralph Nader, who you've just been listening to. And, Ralph, I think that you mentioned Citizens United. And, you know, we hear that term a lot, and people hear about unlimited corporate money. Can you give a little more detail on that? What exactly is that going to mean for someone running for office? I mean, how does that change the game? Because it seems like we were pretty money-drenched already before that decision.
Well, before that decision, corporations could not give checks from corporations like General Motors or Kennecott Copper straight to independent nonprofit committees who then can oppose members, people who are running for office or running for re-election. Now they can pour millions and billions of dollars in these committees, and they can oppose or push for local candidates, state candidates, national candidates. And here's how it works, although it actually this story has a happy ending. Oklahoma City Council race a few weeks ago. There are 7 or 8 members of the city council. This was a runoff for one city council seat that pays $12,000 a year. And a surgeon by the name of Ed Shadid, famous Oklahoma family, whose great uncle started the whole prepaid health insurance movement that preceded Kaiser Permanente and Puget Sound, and had the first hospital co-op run by farmers in the country. Anyway, he's running. He's a progressive. And actually, he ran on the green ticket for 2 years earlier and didn't win. Anyway, he's running against the Democrat choice and in a runoff. And the Democrat spent almost $1 million, but it wasn't his money. It was secret money through these committees. So it was like a dry run of what we're going to see in 2012. But not just at the federal or state level, but at the local level. Fortunately, Dr. Shadid is a very compelling candidate. He knocked on door after door. He had very, very enthusiastic volunteers, and he won by a margin of 2-1. But it's hard to do that citywide. It's hard to do that statewide. It's even harder to do it nationwide. But that's what's coming.
Ralph, when you said secret money, Corporation X wants to donate money. It can be kept secret so the public doesn't know Corporation X is donating money?
That's correct.
And that's protected by the Constitution now, according to the citizens?
According to 5-4 Supreme Court. By the way, that was his major issue. I think he got a lot of votes because he kept saying to his opponent, disclose the secret money, it's bankrolling you. Who's behind you? Come on. Why are they ashamed to tell the voters in my district? See? So that's the counterattack that you can see coming in. But the trouble is, what if they're both, both candidates, Republican and Democrat, are getting from the same reservoir? They're not going to blow the whistle on that because they're getting their own type of secret money.
It seems also, Ralph Nader, that a lot of this money goes to pay for television advertising. What is your sense of the quality of the information that comes through on these TV ads for candidates?
It's garbage. It's just it's manipulation. There was once a famous executive with Foote, Cone, and Belding, the big Madison Avenue advertising firm, and he told me, it was actually on the Today Show, that he was advising Nixon in one of the campaigns, President Nixon, and he said that he wasn't going to do it anymore because there should be a law. Listen to this. From a major advertising executive who knows about soundbites, he said it should be a major law that prohibits any campaign ad less than 5 minutes in duration. So basically, you have these 30-second, one-minute ads. They're heavily emotional, heavily devoid of content, very easily impregnated with deceptive signals, sounds, images, and the rest of it, music, and they're junk. They shouldn't be allowed. Certainly not on the public airways, which belong, as we all know, to the people of this country. They're the landlords. The radio and TV stations are the tenants. They don't pay the FCC a dime for their license. So they get our property free 24 hours a day We can certainly condition the license, not just for political ads. We can give a certain amount of free time to ballot-qualified candidates and reduce the pressure on them to raise special interest money in order to buy ads. But also, we got to go further. I don't know whether you've ever had a workshop at your conference, but we ought to go further and say, what are the people getting by way of reciprocity for having to give away a multi-billion dollar asset 24 hours a day called the public airways? And my answer to that is that we, the audience, should get an audience network with a certain amount of time every day on all licensed TV and radio stations. And we should have the budget come from the license fee that the commercial stations have to pay so that we have our own studios, reporters, producers, and your conference would be beamed live over the air to millions of people. The other reciprocity, which I have not seen talked about, is that the license is conditioned by, say, the Chicago, all the television radio stations, where they have to periodically put a notice on TV or over the radio inviting people to join a national, regional, and local organization of listeners and audiences, and so that there's a lobby that's built up so that many of the reforms you and John Nichols have been proposing in book after book and interview after interview will have real power. But you see, we have to raise our expectation levels. You know, they control us because we don't even think that the definition of freedom is not just using the remote and clicking off a TV program we don't like and moving to another. It's having power to saying, we want some of our property back. We want some of our airways property so we can develop a cultivated culture of our own programming.
Our guest, Ralph Nader. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We have a couple callers waiting patiently. Let's start with line one. You're on the air with Ralph Nader.
Hello. I've been a long-time fan of the program, and I've had to buy a lot of books as a result of your show, so thanks for that. Anyway, I was happy to hear Ralph Nader criticize public broadcasting earlier in the show, because this was something I want to address. And I see a lot of American progressives, you know, making the comparison with Europe and arguing for more public broadcasting. And, you know, I agree your media system is pretty ridiculous and it needs a strong public broadcaster. But I think people are idealizing public broadcasting a bit too much, because here in Holland we do have, you know, public broadcasting, and we do have a few very great programs. For example, consumer programming, something that public broadcasting offers. We have one of our consumer programs is very well watched, despite the fact that it covers some pretty difficult topics, such as complicated insurance scams and such.
This is in Holland you're calling from?
Yeah, I should have identified. This caller is from the Netherlands.
Well, they have very unique system. Very unique system.
Yeah, I know. But they're not right now. They're just austerity and such. So it's being broken down. But, you know, most of the content in Holland is just as uninformative, in my opinion, as American public broadcasting. But I think the main problem isn't just commercialism. It's, you know, a closeness to power. And the same is true in the Netherlands. And, that's it, basically. And,
well, thank you very much, Carla. Let me let Ralph respond. Ralph Nader, I mean, how do we deal with that problem?
As I understood years ago, the system in Holland, a system of magazines, that if a particular magazine's get 1 million subscribers, they get like 3 hours a week on Dutch national TV to program. If they get 500,000, they get less time. Apparently, it's being attacked by the powers that be. But I thought, you know, Bob, it was one of the most creative things I've ever seen in media anywhere in the world. But anyway, the critique of public broadcasting, I've just filed a complaint with the ombudsman for public radio and the public broadcast. Because what I've seen now is we have liberals and conservatives who fight to preserve public broadcast and public radio from attacks on their budget, et cetera, by right-wingers in Congress. And at the same token, the right-wing people like William Kristol and Richard Perle and Robert Kagan and all these people are getting more time on Charlie Rose and on public radio than leading progressive writers and authors and advocates. And speaking for myself, I have not been on Charlie Rose since 2005. He's had Tom Friedman on 75 times. I have not been on Terry Gross ever. She has basically, I think, displayed a bigotry that is not becoming. I've complained about it. It doesn't matter. And I've not been on Diane Rehm since, I think, 2005. And I call them up, and there are all kinds of books out and all kinds of subjects that they are supposed to be covering. No dice. So I think now is to puncture this myth that public broadcasting, radio and TV, is like liberal. I mean, give me a break. They do have some good features all over the world. It's information. Relatively neutral. But when it comes to covering civic action groups, they're absent without leave. When it comes to covering controversial corporate issues, it's very rare. Now, I did get on Scott Simon for my book, Only the Super Rich Can Save Us, which is basically political fiction, not a novel, just out in paperback, folks, which shows what can be done if 17 enlightened billionaires and multi-billionaires of advanced age, real people like Warren Buffett and Ted Turner, Yoko Ono and others, with enlightened backgrounds, decide to get together and put the necessary money, resources, and talent from the communities up to redirect this country in one area after another. And if we don't have these what-if stories, we won't liberate our imagination from our presently discouraged low state in order to envision real possibilities for our country that are long overdue, many of them already established in Western Europe, such as universal health care, zero tuition, higher education, stronger labor laws, many of which are all under attack by corporate globalists in Western Europe, to be sure. But they're still way, way ahead of us. Paid family sick leave, paid daycare, minimum 4 weeks paid vacation for everyone. We don't have that in this country.
Ralph Nader, thank you for mentioning your book, Only the Super Rich Can Save Us. I had that next on my notes. And I've been doing research for the show. I was struck by, for your first novel or first exercise in political fiction, the reviews were rather complimentary. Maybe you had a life in fiction you didn't know.
Well, it's a kind of writing a lot of us can do. Very few people can write novels. I can't write novels. This is political fiction. This is basically saying, well, what if the resources are here? You can see yourself when you have you're having a struggle in a local town or city. You want something changed. You're dealing with a polluter. You're dealing with a zoning issue, or you're dealing with city hall, and you lose. And you're sitting around the cafeteria with your friends who you worked with, and you all lost. And you say, well, what if we had more media? Would it have changed the outcome? What if we had more organizers? What if we had more money? And if we don't envision this, since much of the great social justice movements in our country were significantly funded by rich people, the abolition movement against slavery, more than a few proper Bostonians wrote, put the money in there. The women's right to vote, same thing. The modern environmental civil rights movement, same thing. So what we need to do is get these Warren Buffetts and Ted Turners and William Gates Sr. and many others to think of moving from charity to justice. And I just had a session on May 4th at the New York Public Library with two of the characters in the book, Bob. One was Ted Turner, and the other was Peter B. Lewis of Progressive Insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And that is all online. It's never happened before. The title was of the session in the New York Public Library that evening was Billionaires Against Bull. And it's on the website of the New York Public Library, and you probably will never see something like this. They were pretty candid, and we talked about moving some philanthropic dollars from charity to justice. And, of course, William Gates Jr. and William Buffett have already signed up 65 multi-billionaires here and abroad to pledge half of their wealth to good works. So, in fact, Ted Turner was flying the next day to Phoenix to meet with over 50 because he pledged over half of his. So we have a great opportunity here to do what the right wing has done, is tap into some of these billionaires for action, not just for soup kitchens, but to deal with poverty, to deal with corporate power, to deal with media access. So look at it. And I think in the next couple weeks, C-SPAN was there, and they're going to play it on C-SPAN.
Okay. Thank you for that notification, Ralph Nader. We've got a couple callers who have been waiting patiently. Let's try to get to them right now. Let's start with line 4, Chicago. You're on the air with Ralph Nader.
Good afternoon. How you doing, Ralph?
Very good.
Great. I admire you greatly. I used to hear you all the time on Chuck Carter's show back in the 90s, and I did vote for you back in 04.
Thank you.
I want to ask, since you mentioned on your C-SPAN interview that one of your favorite philosophers is a guy named Henry George.
Yes.
And I happen to be affiliated with an outfit in Chicago called the Henry George School, and so I kind of study that very deeply. And for those who aren't up on it, Henry George was he basically championed a free market, but he said people have to have the wealth to participate in a free market. So he said that wealth has to be redistributed. What do you think, Ralph, about, with respect to the airwaves, George's policy, would that be basically just collecting the rent on the airwaves and leaving the content alone? That's my first question. And
yeah, that's good. That's very right. I mean, he had this phrase, the unearned increment. That is, a lot of very wealthy people in this country who think they made it by themselves in their own initiative. He laughed at that. He said, really, you own a piece of land, the government builds a road near it, suddenly the piece of land increases sixfold. Yeah, you really sweated
exactly
for that one. So he had this single tax idea, which actually a lot of conservatives look benignly on, you would tax the unearned increment of the land value. That's one way. And I think today he would have had a similar application to the commonwealth that we all own, but we don't control and give away free, namely a third of the public of the land in America, the public lands, and we own it. But it's given away largely to mineral companies, oil and gas and gold. And I mean, some of them pay small royalties, but the gold, silver, and molybdenum, hard rock, they get it free, or $5 an acre. A Canadian firm got $9 billion, with a B, dollars of our gold on federal land in Nevada about 12 years ago, and they got it for $30,000. No other country gives away its hard rock minerals like that. So I think Henry George would have had an appropriate unearned increment taxation there, and the same with the public airways, and the same with all the modern industry in our country that was started with taxpayer-funded research and development. You know, like little industries, like half of the pharmaceutical industry, the aerospace industry, the semiconductor computer industry, the biotech industry, the containerization industry. These guys ought to apologize and express their gratitude to the taxpayers, because without government R&D out of the National Institutes of Health, the Pentagon, NASA, they wouldn't be anywhere.
Well, you could look at...
Looks like we seem to have lost line 4, unfortunately, Ralph Nader.
Yeah, sorry.
No, that's quite all right. I'm sorry about that to line 4, because it's a great question. Let's go to line 2 now. Kankakee, you're on the air with Ralph Nader.
Hi, thanks. Great stuff then and now. I'd just like to bring up the issue of public access television. I know that, Barry Goldwater, the conservative, was a big champion at the onset of that, and I was wondering if you could, give your feelings on that. And my suggestion would be that, with the U of I, the School of Communications, I wonder why it is that they don't disseminate some of their knowledge about forming media entities locally, let's say like through the extension system or something like that. And if we did that and we were proactive in that area, do you think that a network could then be set up? And the other thing I would add is that all of the entities that you described in Washington have their local agents, and that's where people's opinion are formed. So just
well, good point.
Yeah, thank you very much, caller. Ralph Nader?
Yeah, I always thought that, you know, public access TV needs a heavy upgrade. It needs more facilities provided by the cable companies. You know, the cable companies are given monopoly markets by local jurisdictions and state jurisdictions. What do we get in return here? What if they had to put a notice on inviting you, the cable viewer, to join your own cable citizen action group with your own professionals representing you, economists and media specialists and lawyers? You think you'd be paying that much every month? You think you'd be getting that much junk on 150 channels? You'd be getting all kinds of different programming. We just don't talk about reciprocity. We got to say, when we have these giveaways, these corporations of public property or public license or public lands or public airwaves or public research and development, what are we getting day after day in return? That's why I wrote this book, Only the Super Rich Can Save Us, to elevate the demand level, to elevate the expectation level of people, which is lower than even many people in Western Europe, had a higher demand to get the communal return, not just wages and salaries, to get their communal return for universal health care and better public transit and better public facilities and cheaper higher education for students and so on. So, you know, Bob, we really need to get over this constant response I get and you get, which is saying, hey, look, there's no more media blockage. We have the Internet. You can get anything you want, anywhere, anytime, virtually free. So stop saying, oh, media monopolies, media restrictions. Oh, really? Huh? Well, what happens? How much information can you get on fine print contracts and that there is a group that is trying to do something about it, which is under one of our groups called CitizenWorks? Look at CitizenWorks.org, and you'll see that we're starting a major challenge against the trillions of dollars that are processed through these fine print insurance, bank, auto dealer, hospital, all these other
cell phone
contracts.
Cell phone contracts?
Yeah, cell phone contracts, right. One-sided, block you from going to court, have bold print that the vendor can change the contract at will, which makes a mockery. A contract shouldn't be changed at will. And they're not competitive between Ford and GM. They're the same contract, so you can't go to a competitor. And these right-wing judges uphold it. So you see, you got to have access. You got to have control, not just access, of some media time. And it's our property, and we ought to get a few hours back every day. Otherwise, we'll take years to get caught up on nanotechnology and the horrific risks and the invasions of privacy that are coming from nanotechnology. The companies just tout the benefits. They don't talk about the risks. We need a citizen action channel full-time, 24 hours a day on cable, showing what people are doing all over the country. So to give morale to other people, to teach other people, and have to reinvent the wheel if something's done in Seattle. Here's how to do it, and here's how they did it in Seattle. Let's go to work, neighbors in Atlanta. We need to know our history of Freedom of Information. Everybody should know how to use the Freedom of Information Act. There's one in every state, and there's a federal one. I just learned, Bob, that last year there were 597,000 requests under the Freedom of Information Act for material from various agencies and departments in the federal government. Well, you know who started that? That was John Moss, Congressman John Moss, who's forgotten to history. One of the most important pieces of legislation, open government. You know, the currency of democracy is information. I'm glad to say, by the way, Bob, that his general counsel has just written his biography, and he'd be a great guest on your show. His name is Michael Lemoff, and he was in it deep on Capitol Hill. He's just put out a book called People's Warrior, John Moss in the fight for freedom of information and consumer rights.
Well, I'll look for that book, and thank you very much, Ralph, for that tip, Michael Lemoff. We do have one more caller I want to get to because we've only got a couple minutes left. Let's go now to line one. Champagne, you're on the air with Ralph Nader.
Yes, thank you, Bob. Thank you, Mr. Nader. It's always wonderful to hear what you have to say. I know time's really short. If you could talk about the prospects for Elizabeth Warren. Daryl Issa has just subpoenaed her to show back up again in front of the House. And
yes, she's a spectacular person in every way, a great communicator. I've rarely seen anyone better communicating financial issues, dealing with credit cards.